said, my inspiration is Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was in a room which has now become a place of pilgrimage in Robben Island, in a prison, for what, 25, 27 years. She said, Nelson Mandela can stay in a cell and abused and mistreated by these white supremacists and stay with that and come out of it with the great moral authority that he has, and no desire for revenge or vengeance on these white racists. She said, I can stay in this house because I have an inspiration. And if he can do 27 years in this house, she says, I can do 27. I was touched. And that's why I feel we need the reminders. We need these beautiful people in this world. There's beautiful histories in this world. Beautiful stories of triumph over the most awful conditions. And I think we need to connect and be inspired and be touched by it. And it nourishes us and it gives us strength. That's history. That's the best of it. Yes, anyone? Yes, sir.
You spoke about the guts.
The guts. Yes.
And just now I had a few questions in my mind. Like, I found out I have, in this presence, I have the answers for many questions, but for these questions I don't have any answers.
No.
Where can I find the courage to... I figured a few days ago I don't have enough courage to really to...
Yeah, it's pardon? Yeah, I know.
I don't have the courage to...
No.
Where can I find the courage in the practice of... When I practice a lot, I become more afraid sometimes.
Yeah, that...
When you become shaky, I don't know.
Yeah, that.
I think I'm going to take all day, I don't know. I think tea or healthy.
All that you said is rather, not easy, but rather healthy. It's rather healthy because the interest is there. It's healthy because one feels the difficulty of finding the courage. There's no simple answer. But what I can say is, see if regularly, and don't forget this, you can take a risk regularly. Take risks. Life is got lots of risks anyway, and they don't have to be full of extremes or anything, but just take a risk. See something which normally we say, I can't, I won't, I shouldn't, I mustn't, I'm not ready, later, etc. And you hear that kind of inner voice which contracts. That's where the fear, the holding goes on. And in spite of not wanting to, in spite of holding back from, if one knows the intention not to cause any harm, and there's no saying, well, I want to really say this, somebody really hurt them, we're talking about risk with respect, that there'll be lots of opportunities in daily life to say to oneself, here, let me take a risk. And if you take the risk, that shows the courage, and the courage will continue the opening up. The opening up will show a bit more fear. A little bit more fear will be revealed. A little bit more fear will say, and then there'll be a deeper voice inside that will say, okay, this is a fresh challenge. Let me take a risk to overcome this one. And if you do that, you'll feel incredibly alive. Incredibly alive. And what's better while we live than to feel we are living? I've just mentioned Aung San Suu Kyi. Some of us have to travel a lot. talking to the group, isn't it, Kiel, a day or two ago, and mentioned what a delight it was that I didn't have to travel for 7 weeks. I didn't get in an aeroplane for 7 weeks. It was the first time in about 20 years, as far as I could. So one goes in and out of airports regularly. I'm not saying this to boast, but just a little bit of... sometimes I've been on the escalator and I've been so tired, you know, I cannot remember whether I'm arriving at an airport, leaving it. And I remember once, I couldn't remember, I was going on the escalator, I couldn't remember what country I was in. Sometimes, so tired, I couldn't remember. Am I just going off to teach or coming back from teaching or leaving? So tired, I just said, what? I'm looking around, what country am I in? Sometimes it's like that. So I was in the home of the Defence Minister of India, not my favourite person on the planet, I must say, George Fernandez. And there were some Burmese students who were there. And they had fled Myanmar, they had fled Burma. It was about 5 or 6 years ago. And they were part of the democratic movement to restore democratic and human rights there. And they're the students, and mostly in their 20s, some in their 30s, been there for years. So they asked me, because I knew I was going to see Aung San Suu Kyi, would I take in some packages for them? And I said, I don't mind what's written, what's typed, and what you want me to give to her, but I won't take anything which has got any mention of violence. Any mention of violence, uprising, you know, in terms of violent uprising, anything which gives support to anything militaristic or violent struggle. And so they gave me an absolute assurance that there'd be nothing in it at all, but to make sure these went only into the hands of Aung San Suu Kyi and that nobody else would get it. So I said, okay, alright. So I put them in my bag at Delhi Airport, checked in, flew into Bangkok into Myanmar. Some of you, any of you have been to Rangoon, you know, so it's a military state. Soldiers are there even when the luggage arrives. So it's amazing how one little thing, the level of energy and awareness, you know, usually you arrive at an airport, you know, where's the bag, you know, wait for the bag to come. It's amazing how you're waiting and the soldiers are standing around watching as well. And one poor Englishman got 14 years in jail. So anyway, so, yes, a bit more time for meditation, I suppose, anyway. And then everything went all right, and took it through. You know, I could easily have said no, and they would not have minded. But then when I met with, got the package to her, you know, she couldn't take it to the house because all the soldiers were there. Then I had to get it, you know, somewhere else, secret meeting, somewhere in Rangoon. And then her cousin came to, you know, it's all roundabout ways how these things go. So then, met with Aung San Suu Kyi. And then she said, Christopher, could you take some packets out for me? Having just been pleased I'd taken them in and kind of got away with it, she said, could you take some out for me? Would you make sure that nobody else gets their hands on them? Right. Let me go through the whole thing. So I just use it, nothing significant about it, but I just use it that sometimes there's things in life, it's a day-to-day life where it's just worth our while just taking a risk, taking a step. Any kind of risk, I always remind myself, and I hope you all do as well, that it gives no guarantee that it will work out okay. One just doesn't know. But one just trusts the heart's in the right place, the intention is okay, it's supporting something that one believes is important, and one just has to trust whatever bit naive, a bit silly, a bit romantic, you know, some friends, family think it's I'm completely stupid, etc. Yet it's vital. And you'll find lots of different ways in your life. There's opportunity to take risk, and there's a certain edge to it, and it gives a certain aliveness, gives an extra energy, and a certain satisfaction at the end, I have to add. Yes, sir.
It's a question that a wonder that came with the metaphor of sleeping and nobody.
Yes, all right.
The first association I had with sleeping.
Yes.
With passive state.
Passive. Hmm. Yep.
Very,
very extremely, absolutely. People could be running around when we're sleeping. We would know. Very passive. I think my daughter does. Anyway, sorry, carry on. Yes. Yeah.
We'd like to hear from you. Yeah. As you are the most active nobody.
Mm-hmm.
What's the drive and motivation that you have?
What's the drive and motivation?
To do the things you do. And even to take risks, that you just said. When it is got nothing to do with self or ego.
Yeah. I think in a very simple and not especially profound way, I like people. I like people. And I love people. And in a very small, effective, ineffective, whatever way, I get a lot of joy out of being a servant of others. I like people. Could be. I mean, I agree. It could be. But it's within myself, yeah, that it's a kind of feeling which is present. And so far it's been unstoppable. So far. Eh? Oh, all right, thank you. I mean, certain people in this world I find difficult with a pain in the neck. You know, 99.9% of them are politicians, etc. But I like people, even politicians. So, that kind of feeling brings this kind of joy and happiness that goes with it. And I equally like, if I may say, being without people. I mean, I like myself, you might say. I like being alone, I like my solitude, I like my quietness as well, I love that as well. So it's between this and other. The feeling flows rather, so far, rather easily, and doesn't feel inhibited. It feels free. That's not a very profound response, but one. Yes, please.
You
can ask anything.
So much, so I'm just curious, what do you write as your occupation when you go, you know, in this form, Android form in the airport?
Oh, yes, right. Usually I write teacher, and sometimes when it's even sitting on the aeroplane, I probably had about, rarely talk to a person on the aeroplane. You know, I prefer to space out looking out the window or something. But sometimes people ask, and they say, oh, teacher, and they say, oh, teaching in high school, teaching university, etc. Usually if I say meditation teacher, it usually ends the conversation extremely quickly. You know. There's a certain kind of relief in that, I have to say. There. So that's what I usually put, teacher. And then if they ask me, then they say, oh, that's a spiritual thing, and so on. Something like that. And I was coming out of California, out of San Francisco, 2001 or 2002. And of course they're very, very careful because of the horror of events. So he opened up, they were doing very careful checks of all the passports. I think it could have been last year, the year before, I can't remember. But anyway, he was doing a very careful check at San Francisco, looking at everybody's passport, etc. Then he looked at mine, anyway. Israeli stamp. Another one. I think this is my fourth time here, I think. Fourth time in the last year. Yeah. And he said, you go to Israel rather a lot. And I said, well, I like it. There. And then he said, why do you go? I said, well, I have lots of friends there, etc. I said, He said, oh, you could be a peace activist. What? He said, okay. Yes.
Taking a little bit back.
Yes, please.
I have a little difficulty in putting together, looking at history.
Yes.
And my personal.
Yes. Yes.
Same language.
No.
Mental language.
Yes.
You can talk about history of a country or religion.
Yes.
But I don't really know. Maybe it's my problem.
No.
Mm-hmm. I don't find it the same way of talking or looking or thinking about it. Much too personal, I
have
for me.
Yeah.
Is it the same language?
I think the language, I think, from first my...
Inside language.
Pardon?
Inside language.
The inside language, I agree. Sometimes it's history. One is the what we call the personal. Mostly, what has happened to me in my life. And as I was saying in the talk with you this evening, that there's much insight. There's a whole wealth of experiences that we have had, personal life story, personal life, which can be phenomenally helpful for insight and understanding. And in that respect, our returning our attention to the past can really help nourish, open our life up inwardly for the present. There's the personal history. And then there's the history of our traditions there. And that may be social, religious, spiritual. And of course, Jewish tradition has a wealth of history in it, as you know, 3,000 years or 4,000 years or more. And once again, in the deeper religious spirit of it, there's tremendous amount of wealth of stories and revelations of discoveries there. And hopefully between our own history and the long history, or the history of men and women on earth, the wisdom of the earth. You know, I might draw from the Buddhist tradition more than others, because that's where my adult life has been so connected with. But the stories and the history and the experiences and the inspirations, and hopefully we can find a language within all of that which, again, gives us support.
But I'm talking more about living it.
Living it?
No,
leaving it. E-E-A. All right, not L-I-V. All right, I get it. Leaving it.
I could much more easily leave the common past, but when I get attached to something in my personal past,
yeah,
much more pain and much more...
Yes. Yeah. So then we look at, we say, I'm on a path, and to be aware of what the benefits are. Have you seen anything with yourself, which say in any kind of personal spiritual path, which is contributing to some pain for you? Does anything come to mind?
My own past?
Yeah, past, yeah, or path, past.
Yeah, it's not really spiritual,
I know.
My childhood, I had to leave some anger I had. I mean, wow, it's so
yeah. No, that's all right. That's all right. You don't have to do the story if you wish. Like, yeah, for example...
Like, when you lose a parent. Yeah. Mm. I lost a parent.
Yes.
I think 1 month ago, I said goodbye to one anger I had. On
yes.
So it's a lifetime work. I mean, it's not,
yes,
it's not something I can...
No. So...
I haven't
learned
5 years ago, so...
Yes. The beautiful thing, is sometimes we can look at the past like that, and we can say goodbye, say, to anger. We can rise above what was. You know, my own mother's a rather lovely example. Her upbringing was dreadful. Neither a mother or father took any real interest in her for a start. They were off here and there because the world of airlines had just started. He was a manager of Baghdad Airport at the time, and etc. She was just moved from one relative to another. They were having their nice middle class bourgeois lifestyle, etc., etc., and my mother was just pushed from one household to another. And that could have left her, as it does leave some people, feeling very hurt, embittered, rejected, resentful, and it kind of carries the anger through the rest of life. The actuality of it is that she's a genuinely very, very loving and deeply good human being, a deeply good person to be around, and generous to the to an extraordinary degree. And I wonder, what is it that there can be such a painful path of being rejected as a young child and neglected, you know, and all the anger that can go with it, that somehow through all of that a human being can work through all of that, not necessarily consciously, doesn't have those kind of skills, and come out of it, and something very deep goodness manifests out of it, deep kindness, deep generosity. And I think each time we say goodbye to the anger and goodbye to the resentment and we let go of it, we make ourselves open to something beautiful. And I think let's be in a constant process of saying goodbye to problems of life, to the history, to problematic history. And if we find a language for it, good. If we don't, I think goodbye is more than enough words. Yes, anyone, please. A couple more minutes and then we'll... Yes.
Know yourself as the person that, you know, or like a fire, you know,
yes,
light up like a fire. Just starting to accept it, you know, if you're an angry, if I'm getting angry,
hmm,
probably part of my personality.
Hmm.
I get...
Yeah, sure.
So I'm starting to accept it.
All this is very healthy and wonderful practice, to accept difficult things of the personality. But I'll say again, the best of who you are is beyond your personality. The best of who you are is beyond the personality. Even the nice features of you, even the good features, even what your friends and family say, oh, really, I like you because of this or that, your personality. The best of who you are is before the personality gets underway. Isn't it? Cream of the milk. And that's where the meditation and the awareness, before the mind gets going, before the personality gets going, in all the ways that it does. You know, I sit here, I reveal aspects of my personality. Quite clearly, you talk to me, you reveal aspects of yours, etc., etc. But before the personality gets moving, gets underway, before that starts, this is our true nature. This is our original nature. This is worth loving and knowing and being with the best. Personality is just social entertainment.
Does that mean that we're not different?
Ultimately, we're not different and we're not the same.
We're not the same because you're teaching against identity.
We're not, yeah, not different? How could we be? If we were really different, we couldn't communicate for a start. So there's the common, but we're not the same. Mark is Mark, Christopher is Christopher. We're not the same. But the true nature, doesn't live in the world of being the same or being different. This is breathtakingly beautiful. And let's have a shared minute together, shall we? All right. Thank you. She whispered a word, I'll tell you in a moment. Thanks. May all beings live a free life. May all beings embrace past, present and future. May all beings live with deep connectedness. But thank you everyone for coming. So just whispered the word dana. Yeah, some of you may think this is perhaps another teacher or something. But the word means donation. It means acts of generosity. It means acts of support. So, as you leave the Dharma hall, the meditation hall, most of us just look to the left. In this case, we really want to encourage you to look to the right. And you'll see two magnificent bowls there, and written in the best Hebrew handwriting I heard, well, and English, you'll see dana or donation. And Iran said, how many thousands of shekels needed to be made? What was the figure?
4,500.
Oh, not so many thousands, all right. So, in terms of putting on the actual Dharma program here. There's a whole variety of costs, of course, the rent and use of the facility. There's the various travel expenses. There's the food bills. There's the mailing and the information and the telephone calls and the printing of leaflets and flyers and all that that goes to help put such an event together. And the Tovana has put in much love and time and care in just finding this facility, let alone all the other aspects that go with this. So it's our request that if you could be so kind as to give some support to the program, the teachings, in terms of making them available over this period of time, which started yesterday evening through until lunchtime on Wednesday. And the other which gives support as well, besides the overall putting of the program together, is for the beggar sitting at the front here. And so a board goes out for beggars and managing beggars and etc, etc, etc. And again, any support which comes from you really helps. We, the servants of Dharma, do rely on the kindness and the goodwill and the generosity to pay our way, to pay the various ongoing bills, etc, etc, both as a householder and as a parent, as a grandparent too. I know a two-year-old, my daughter's in university hospital training to be a midwife, etc. And really through the kindness of the Sangha that gives support to myself, and so I can also say my dear daughter is equally grateful for the dana, because often it goes in my hand and it goes out my hand and into my daughter's, etc., to help pay her way through her education. And many of you know this yourself. So we, as teachers and staff as well, don't get any stipend, we don't get any wages, we don't get any salary, we just run on trust that money will come, trust that bills will get paid and support will come in. And some of us have been living this way, both in my 6 years as a Buddhist monk and then as a Dharma teacher, so more than 30, well over 30 years now. And it's lovely, challenging, of course, way to live with the uncertainties that can go along with it, but it all occurs and is only able to continue, because people say the teachings matter. They are rather priceless teachings. We don't feel comfortable in making a charge with money going directly to the teacher. We prefer just to have trust that in this case, the 4,500 shekels that Ivan just referred to cover all the running costs of the program will come in with kindness and goodwill and generosity of your ward. Some donations will come in for myself, managers, to give support as well. And that's how we flow along. Week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out. And our gratitude and our appreciation to you is very, very much appreciated. So without straining your eyes, if you could keep one eye for the right and one eye for the left, we'd be very grateful. And thank you very much. Okay, and tomorrow again have a full program, full starting in the morning with some Tai Chi and yoga teacher. Oh, so tomorrow morning is yoga class at the beginning of the day, some discussions, meetings with Stephen and myself. Anyone else tomorrow, Stephen? Just you and me?
Jonathan
will come? Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. So do please come along, and I'll try to remember tomorrow what time I'm on duty for the small groups and not get the wrong time. There and so look forward to seeing you tomorrow, and we'll engage in some explorations tomorrow evening. But so you've been very good, very patient, couple of hours. It's 8, 10 o'clock, time goes, huh? Good rest, good sleep, good journey home. God bless. One of the most beautiful and significant expressions of wisdom in daily life is our capacity to rest in the moment, no matter what the moment is, no matter where it is. And it's a genuinely deep and profound expression of wise seeing and wise understanding to be able to appreciate, remember, discover what it is just to be, just to rest in this moment. And in the expression of our resting in the moment, there's a certain quality in our inner life, in that moment, which is one of not wanting for anything anywhere. And this intimates, this indicates to us that we're resting in the moment. I'm not wanting anything from myself. I'm not wanting anything from anyone else who is around. I'm not wanting anything from the past, nor from what's happening in the present, nor wanting for anything in the future. And this ability to let fade away the importance of time, past and things, what's going on with the present out there, and the future, gives our whole being real moments of rest. It's not that you and I can be constantly at rest every single moment. Our mind does need to move. We do need to turn our attention to what was, to what is, and to what will be or might be. So we look at our inner life and we say, here I am, I'm a human being, I'm a conscious human being, and as a conscious human being I can turn my attention to what was, what is, and what might be. So my consciousness can go to any one of these three fields of time. My consciousness doesn't absolutely live in the time, but it often moves to it. I could say right now, I have no conscious interest in what was. I have no conscious interest in what will be tomorrow or day after, etc. And all the interest, all the focus, all the consciousness is right here and now. Is it, as I speak with you, and is it also equally, of course, as you listen? For the one who is the speaker, do I feel, as it were, pulled out of myself? Do I feel, as I speak, in some way I am dependent upon? Am I nervous about what I might say or am saying? Am I concerned about what will come to me from the present moment, i.e. others, will they stay, will they leave, etc. So even in the present moment we can, so to speak, be kind of pulled out of ourselves. We're not so much in the moment, purely, we're rather in our thoughts about it. We're in our projections about it. We're caught up in what is going on in the moment. So the expression of life is, here is consciousness, meaning being conscious. Come in, find a seat. And my consciousness moves towards what was, becomes involved in what is, or what will be. So this resting in the moment, if it's deep and if it's clear, this is the important thing with the moment, the content, this is where liberation is knocking on our door and not far away from being. The content of what I see doesn't matter too much. The content of what I hear doesn't matter, or what I might smell, or what I might touch, body with the cushion or mat, etc. So, often with our life, it seems like, as a human being, I'm very much involved in time. I'm very much involved in what happened. I'm very much involved in what's going on in the present moment. And I'm very much involved in what the future will or might be. When I'm genuinely resting in the moment, the colors and shapes that come to my eyes are not so important. I could be here, I could be outside, I could be in another place, I could be in a football match, I could be in a cave. What I hear doesn't matter too much. What I feel, the contact of the body, or what I touch with my hands, doesn't matter too much. So there is a way of being with consciousness which is not caught in the field of time. That we can say, in the seeing, the eyes, there's just the seeing. With the hearing, there's just the hearing. With the smelling, tasting, touching, there's just the touching. And that sense of consciousness, being conscious, not so dependent on what was, what is, or what will be, begins to get a little sense of that which is timeless, meaning not lost in time. And all spiritual teachings point to the realization, the abiding with what is timeless. And the extraordinary thing is, the here and now moment is a wonderful key to sensing something timeless. Because if in a seeing, it's just a seeing, what's the difference between yesterday, today, and tomorrow? What's the difference? What's the difference if in the listening there is just the listening, between just the listening last month or last year, or when I was a child, listening yesterday and listening today? What would be the difference between today and tomorrow if in the seeing there's just the seeing? The differences will be maybe little changes in the color. That little is the difference. So perhaps the big divisions that we make between yesterday and today and tomorrow are not really out there and all the ups and downs that go with it, but rather, and this is important, what we make of it. What we make of yesterday, what we make of today, and what we make of tomorrow. And the world of big division and separateness requires from us, we have to make something of it. So our wonderful capacity, precious conscious capacity, just to be in the moment, and to rest in the moment, when we stop making something of time and to rest in that, maybe that will give us a little whisper, a little sense of kind of freeing our spirit, kind of embracing yesterday, today and tomorrow. And consciousness is a wonderful key. Sometimes, as was mentioned at the beginning there, we talk about responsibility. We are often told we should be more responsible. It's a favorite mantra of some parents. It comes from our educators. It comes from the regularity of pressure. It comes from parents about themselves, etc. And in this area sometimes I feel a little uncomfortable is, how do we hear the word? And some of us, when we hear the word responsibility, it carries lots of ought-tos and shoulds and musts. It carries a kind of weight with it. And what we sometimes notice in ourselves or with others, that when we're putting a lot of pressure on a person, we should show more responsibility. This is a favorite one-liner. But this kind of pressure produces sometimes quite the opposite. There's a kind of reaction. And the reaction is sometimes to do the opposite. I was just talking to friends just a while ago. We were in a yatra, a peace walk. You will have seen some of the information on the table there, and certainly would encourage anyone who has never been in a meditative, mindful, consciousness, caring kind of peace walk with silence and presence to really strongly recommend to participate. It's quite an extraordinary thing to participate, and it's rather than responsibility, it is responsibility, the ability to respond. So we had one recently in England, and more or less at the same time another demonstration, this is of course, you know, against this planned bombing and destruction of the people of Iraq, and the police in with the other demonstrators said to the group, using their authority and with some pressure, you have to walk along the seafront. It was in Brighton, southern England. Now, to walk along the seafront in the middle of winter means it would be whatever, one guest of each floor of the hotel, have a look outside, see what's going on. Nobody's on the seafront in the middle of Brighton in the winter, or very, very few. And on the beach, one of the stoniest beaches on the planet, you know, you get the odd hero with their dog, etc. So, the demonstrators, with the police putting pressure on them and trying to block the road up the main street of shoppers, told them where to go. You have to go this way. And the group just quite spontaneously said no, and in typical English anarchist spirit went the complete opposite way to what the police wanted. There might have been a little negotiation, but once they were told by authority, this is typical in England, once you get told by authority, you have to, all the rebellion comes up. You know, we have a very strong punk tradition. I have, someone sent me a beautiful t-shirt, which I delightfully wear sometimes on retreats. And because a friend of mine said to me, because my niece has started up a t-shirt company in London, and it has a logo on it, and the name, he said, you may not be very happy with the name of the logo company. And he because it's on every t-shirt they send out, very beautifully designed, and its name of the company is Buddhist Punk. I said, oh, I must have. Must have. I want. So one gave in a little. So sometimes I can walk into meditation room with this Buddhist Punk written right across. I just love it. So sometimes where there is pressure upon us, the pressure brings about reaction. It brings about rebellion. And we do the opposite of what we're told, just because we're being told, just because of the pressure. And it's often the language of taking responsibility in some way or other. So to be able to respond, and one of the dilemmas that arises for us is, we're working with others, a number of you in the room here, work with others, you serve others, you share and offer your skills to others, you contribute to others, maybe in the role of leadership, it may be in the role of family, it may be in the role of work and service, etc., etc. And very easily in our commitment and connection with others, this shows responsibility. If we have the feeling of responsibility for others, we have a feeling of responsibility for what is happening, two things easily occur, and often we are hardly conscious of them. One is the dependency on results. I engage in a form of service, whoever I am. I'm a teacher, a Dharma teacher, let's say. I'm managing. I'm doing for others. I can trust in my expression of what I do, and it's important that you and I do that. But if I take responsibility for what the end result, if I take responsibility for that, the welfare of my mind, the peace of my mind, is dependent on the state of mind of other people. Whoa! Risk! Some of us rather walk the tightrope between two skyscrapers and have more trust in that than have a feeling of responsibility for other people's states of mind. So we have to check in with ourselves. Shall we say, the goodness of my intention, in the way that I serve others, the form, the vehicle that I use, is for the most part my trust and confidence in the expression, and that I am willing as much as I possibly can to leave the outcome in the results of the conditions, in the results of the person's life, in their capacity or lack of it to be receptive, to connect, to feel the benefit or whatever. Sometimes, and I think it's a very important lesson for us, sometimes in what we do for others, it seems to have the opposite effect of what we want. I say, we had a meeting about this on the first evening that I arrived here last Wednesday, a public meeting. And the public, some of you might have been at that public meeting. It was on spiritual emergencies. There's a concern here, as well as in all the other countries, that of the number of people who are engaged in retreats, workshops, programs, yoga classes, therapy, deep meditations, etc., 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 the whole spectrum of things, of spiritual exploration. The intention of the participants and the intention of the leaders, of course, is to really help, to help people live harmonious, integrated lives. And sometimes on a retreat, or in a workshop, or in a program, or whatever, the complete opposite can happen. Somebody can put their back out in a yoga, and for months and months be on their back. Somebody can, in a retreat, can fall into a psychotic, what psychiatrists would call psychotic episode. Somebody else can have an incredible emotional breakdown, or go into an existential crisis, and it takes a long time to work through that process. If one, the leader, the facilitator, the teacher, the guide, or whatever, is taking responsibility for what outcomes, it's very, very hard to deal with painful outcomes. The intention is good. The wish for the welfare of the other person or persons is good. But it's not in our hands. It's not in our hands. So, those of you who know the Bhagavad Gita, which is it's a wonderful ancient text there. There's Krishna speaks of karma yoga, meaning service. The yoga of service to others. Yoga of action. And one of the clear messages that he gives all of us, a very, very important reminder about, is no attachment to results. Watching this tendency that you and I have of taking responsibility for the result. The second aspect as well, which is equally important, is if I don't realize it, let's say I'm caring for others, I have the feeling of, doing my very, very best as a human being to serve others, and I'm expressing responsibility for others. Let's say if it's in a group situation, if there is an exaggeration of responsibility, even if it's giving us a lot of pleasure, one sees the benefit. One hardly realizes one is taking some responsibility for the benefit. One feels very, very good about the appreciations, about the expressions of acknowledgement. But what easily happens if there is any exaggeration of the responsibility? What happens when there are fewer people? What happens when one is going from a bigger group to a smaller group? Then the responsibility then comes back to oneself. And so people in a kind of kindness have been showing responsibility to others, haven't realized the degree of dependency in the responsibility, and so the group goes from 20 people to 10 people. The responsibility has to go somewhere, and it comes back on us. And then we think, oh, people are not staying. Oh, there weren't so many people as there were on the last retreat or the last course or the last program, or people are not signing up, or people are staying away, and it must be something to do with me, it must be something that I am doing wrong, or we are doing wrong. So the movement of the responsibility, first it went out there, then there were less for it to go out there, it's got to go somewhere, it comes straight back, and then we end up taking responsibility for not enough people. We're taking responsibility for somebody who puts their back down, somebody who has a breakdown. So it's very important that we watch the water. Great. So it's rather important in life that we watch this movement. Parents do it. They do it brilliantly unwell. Brilliantly. I mentioned with my earlier today with my good mother. When I hitchhiked years ago to the east and then decided to become a Buddhist monk, to become a Buddhist monk, one firstly has to inform the person or persons who is closest to one. And the second, one must be free of debt. And the reason for both in taking ordination is that to become, the reason one must take, and my power of attention in the present matters and always matters more than what was. And therefore I have to ask myself, am I really, really committed to a resolution of what was in order to be free in the present for what is? And if I haven't made up my mind, good luck with your existence. Because the old past, bum, 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 bum. And we say, I don't like this, I don't want this, I want this, etc., etc. And then we go to talk with our friends or others, and they say, oh, yes, I know how you feel. The same thing happened to me. So then two people enter into a collusion of reinforcing how miserable their past was there. And, of course, as we know, poor old parents have got a terrible rap, partly through Freud, I have to say. And we put it all there, in there. The Dharma teachings put the significance on the present moment. Is there the power of attention in the present moment? Is there the wish to resolve? Is there a simple underlying question at work with regard to what was? Either am I willing to accept what happened, or am I willing to change? And if you and I think of anything in terms of what was at any level, am I willing to accept? Am I willing or am I able to change? If so, can we be clear, deep down inside of ourselves? Sometimes, with the past, it's comforting. It's lovely. You and I will turn our attention to the past and we will say, God, that was great. Whatever it might say. Great retreat. I'm about to say that. I teach retreats. So, oh, that was a great retreat. Oh, we might say, that was a great holiday. Oh, that was a great place to be. Oh, that was a great time that I had with this person or place. Oh, that was lovely, wonderful being out in the nature. So sometimes the relationship to the past, or with other things, it's great to be part of, it's great to belong to, all this. And it gives us, humanly enough, lots of pleasurable, lovely feelings through memory. But what happens if we identify with it? What happens if we make a big fuss about it? What happens if we build the past up? Of how great it was, how pleasurable, how wonderful, how extraordinary it was, what a wonderful person I am, what a wonderful people we are, or whatever it might be. What happens to the present? What happens with it? You have a wonderful time in some fantastic beach somewhere, whatever, you have a lovely holiday, and there's all this pleasurable thought and memory coming, and then one imagines that when I go back, I'll repeat the experience. It will come back just like it was. It'll be just as great as when it was. How many times has there been disappointment? How many times have we imagined yesterday and today how it was yesterday? Could it be that it really wasn't like that? Could it be that it wasn't what happened in the past, but the huge pleasure I got from building the memory? You know, having been to India every year since 1974, and having been there before that as well, I love hearing the old India Wallahs stories about their trips to India. Is it telling us about India or telling about the trip? No, some people have been to India and they say, God, I was here last in India. My money got stolen and I got malaria and I got diarrhea and hepatitis and I did this retreat and I went to Goa and I rotted on some other beach on the other side, etc., etc. And all these stories, and even all the misery of lying in some miserable hotel room, miserable as sin, sick, spending more time squatting on the toilet than sitting on the meditation cushion. All this, then returning back home and telling all these great stories of what one experienced in India and how extraordinary it was as I lay dying in the toilet spewing every night. And the actuality and the memory get no relationship, because the memory has converted and changed something from being problematic and difficult to pleasurable. And sometimes we do this to such a degree in life, we're a bit out of touch with what actuality is. So teachings point out, to quote the Buddha, be aware of thoughts about what I was, how I was, when I was, where I was, how I was. If, as to repeat a little bit, I could put some of that, maybe if I was courageous enough, put all of that aside and say, past is past. Could it possibly allow me to have a little bit of heart and a little bit of consciousness and a little bit of all, not a little bit, all that I call myself? All that I call myself, I say, pah, akinchana, nothing. Unimportant. All that I call myself is unimportant in this extraordinary nature of things. And if I truly realize one's unimportance, one's insignificance, truly willing to feel it in the bones, few are willing, my God, the life opens up in some other way. Some other sense of things, which is hidden because of the self. Is it any wonder teaching of the East, of letting go of the self, or the Buddha said, see the self, see the emptiness of self, see the falseness of I, me and my, see the fiction of it, see the hopelessness of it, see the inability to control it, master it, keep it, hold on to it. Every night you and I go to bed. Every night. What's the priority? What's the great interest? When we put the old head down, as we will do in an hour, a couple of hours, and some will do it here if they get the chance. Put the head down. What's the great interest? It's for all the machinery, the factory of the self, to stop. We don't want a single thought about yesterday. We don't want a single thought about oneself. We don't want a single thought about today. and we don't want a single thought about tomorrow. We have one interest in going into sleep, that the whole damn show is over for a few hours. And if we wake up in the morning and say, my God, I had such a deep sleep last night. I didn't wake up. There's no nightmares, no dreams, not waking up thinking about myself and who I am and what I am or who we are and what we are. God, it was brilliant. We just love a deep sleep in which all the I, me and my completely finishes for several hours. We love it. We don't want to wake up in the morning and think, oh my God, I spent the whole damn night thinking about myself, my family, my job, my country, my race, my culture, my history, So there's a deep wish to get out of the self. Dharma teachings say, get out of it morning, noon and night. That's all. Morning, noon and night. Not just 7 or 8 hours a night. Morning, noon and night. Because we love the depth of being out of the self. This freedom is available for all who are willing to see the emptiness of all expression of I and my or I and us. Some say, whoa, wait a minute. No, thank you. Okay. Live in the world of I and us. Live in the world of I and us. It's not liberation. It's an imprisonment. Emotional, psychological, historical imprisonment. And the teachings of liberation are the teachings of coming out of the imprisonment. And in coming out of the imprisonment, the outcome of it is an extraordinary respect for all beings without exception. That's the outcome. It's a natural outcome from it. Can I ask in a little bit about this? There is no point in a poor Dharma wala like Christopher as a Dharma teacher or anyone else talking about deepest things of life if one doesn't know it clearly in the moment. So therefore, when asked about what is Christopher's experience, I've just spent the last 30 minutes saying what it is. That the awareness knows the emptiness of I, me and my, and the great freedom of being that flows with it. Sometimes, for some fears may arise, and a cloud passes across the consciousness. But there is a knowing, and in the knowing which is there, the thought is unable to justify it. The thought can't justify it anymore. It sees the movement, sees the fear arising in the consciousness. It knows it to be a fear. And it knows it's got no relationship to truth. It's just the movement over the consciousness in the moment. And so, it's not for us to say, as some people do, and some people tell me and try to convince me, oh, Christopher, we need fear. Really? Really? We need fear? You know, one of the old Indian sages, which kind of sums it up far better than Christopher's words, was giving a talk. And one person was sitting up in the balcony in the theatre. So he shouted down to the speaker, the teacher, the Dharma teacher, and said, we need fear. Fear protects us. It's fear which stops me from jumping off this balcony and breaking my neck and killing people below. So we need fear. Fear stops me from doing stupid things. We need fear. And the speaker shouted out, "Sir, that's not fear which stops you, that's intelligence." So, can we bring some wisdom, some intelligence to life? Not reify, that means give substance to fear. So that we genuinely know a sense of profound freedom with the day. And that, as I was saying in the talk yesterday evening, the moments of identity which are arising and passing through the day do not have continuity in truth. Even sleep sees to that. Just a human being sleeping in that moment, we wouldn't know anything about the person until he or she said something. That it could it be possible for us to be able to look at the influence of yesterday today, realize a great freedom of being there, and when fear sometimes arises and passes, could there be just enough awareness to say, this is just some fear which is only doing one thing, to arise, to do one thing, to pass. That's all it's for. Oh, the old heart would be happy, spacious, clear, natural freedom of life, and loving and concern for others who live in fear. Who live in fear. Let's have a quiet minute and then some exploration. Any comments, responses, questions, whatever, all yours, any way you wish to express. Yes, please, yes. Yeah, absolutely, yes. Yes, do.
Might sound rude.
Rude? Go on, express it well then.
My first question is, are you a beggar?
Beggar. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Second question is, don't you have to be a great man or personality in order to be able to be a nothing?
All right. Good. The three questions, or should I go for the two?
The first question is, could you please help me learn how to clean yourself in the situation of not reality, but everyday life, you know?
Yeah.
We can't sit here all day just leaving everything. For babysitters and things like that.
No. Yeah. Right. But the first one. The first question: am I a beggar?
What?
One response is no. Any other response is yes. But no. To be running to the sense doors, trying to get things, and dependent on that, whether it's running around the shopping mall or running around there, get for me. We are beggars. I don't wish to live like that, I don't live like that. We are beggars at the sense doors. I want that. And this is for soul has no interest nor appetite for. I don't wish to live my life as a beggar at the sense doors. In another respect, the beggar is regarded as the lowest of the low. Is regarded as a nobody. The lowest of the low. All the realms of society, and then there are the beggars, etc., etc. So, in being the lowest of the low, being the nobody, yes, wonderful, wonderful, I love it. And therefore the outer function called being a Dharma teacher, let's say that role, or being a parent, or being a writer, you know, whatever the kind of role that one has in life. No matter where one looks, even right now, the role of teacher can't actually be found anywhere. Where? Sitting cross-legged? Sitting on a bench or bed, which as one could collapse at any time? Where is this teacher? Where is the Englishman? Where? Can't find. Thank God. Adventure. So this world, everyday world, conventional world, one sees the emptiness of it, one's a nobody. Not a teacher, nobody. Not an Englishman, nobody. To be nobody is, it's so sweet. Nothing to protect, nothing to have to defend, nothing to worry about, because one sees the emptiness of it. So being a nobody, being a beggar or a nobody is such a blessing in life. Such a blessing. Third question with regard to how, the favorite, how. Two things which immediately come to mind now, or two or three things. One is the wonderful capacity and importance of meditation. You know, so if we take just the Buddhist tradition for a moment. I couldn't care less whether the Buddha lived or whether he didn't. Example. It just doesn't bother me at all. Not my interest. And I couldn't care about Buddhism, let us say. The Buddha would be quite happy to attend the funeral of Buddhism. And probably help to throw some dirt on the grave. But there's something about the power of meditation, to meditate, to really generate in our time for meditation, to be still, to be aware, to be conscious, to be in the moment, to be doing nothing. And sometimes when we sit in meditation, and just to move our hand to scratch our knee, we can feel right in the meditation we have done too much. As the practitioners will say, which has gone from one generation of monasteries to the other, we have disturbed the world of 84,000 things. And sometimes we just go sitting in the stillness bed, and then we just go, done too much for the day, moving the hand from the palm to the knee. And there's something very precious in the silence, in the stillness, where in a way we're nobody. I don't have any particular job, role, position, relationship, etc. We're really coming back to just being. And at the best we can say, well, at the moment I'm a human being. It's the last little hope of being somebody. But even this idea, I'm a human being, but just to be in the stillness, in the silence. So one is meditation. The second, equally as important, and often neglected, is the capacity we have just to reflect, just to find time in our life to, as we did in our discussion, exploration this morning, reflecting on what matters, what really matters. What is it about the here and now that matters? What is there to be discovered in the here and now? What contributes to me feeling really connected with this immediacy of life? So some reflection to remind us, so that we're spending, as it were, less time in memory, less time in the future, and more time in the power, or as Simi said with the group, in her group this morning, the empowering of presence. Presence empowers us. Presence gives us the power to look at the past and see what's useful and what's to be let go of, what's to be accepted and what's to be changed, etc. The power of the coming out of the presence, our strength of the, as a being, comes out of the here and now. Our stillness gives us inner strength and power. And so the second is reflection. What matters? What helps me to feel really connected? What shows love? What shows awareness? What shows intelligent living? So we can use reflection with each other as a second. And the third great resource is the nature. It's no coincidence that many of the most beautiful monasteries and spiritual places in the world are often found in beautiful places in the nature. And there's something very beautiful about contact with the nature. And I think one of the crippling and emotionally, psychologically, and especially spiritually destructive things about urban society is not the buildings, they're neutral. It's not the sheer numbers of people, but it's the alienation that it brings from nature. And it's the alienation because we forget organic life and we live in mechanistic life, we live in technological life, we live in cyberspace non-life. And the more time we spend in that, the more alienated and distant we come. And that the presence of meditation, genuine reflection, contact with the nature, will answer and attend to every concern of your life that matters. All of them without exception. Between those three, they're great vehicles for all of us. Absolutely. Yes, anyone, please. Yes.
Nature issues, interesting. Can you expand a little bit about gratitude? I mean, you say we should go live in there or try to be there as much as possible? Or what? How can you find it in your life?
Yep. Years ago, a friend of mine was a doctor, a new doctor, 28, 29 years of age. And he was doing the walk around the wards. And he came to one far end of the hospital. And in there was a woman. And this woman was in an iron lung. She'd had polio as a child and was in an iron lung. And at the bottom of the bed was her chart. Name, address, telephone number, her temperature, the blood, heartbeat, details that they put on it. And it included date of admission into the hospital. And she said, and it said, you get the exact number of years. I think it was 28 years in this hospital bed. Couldn't leave because of the needing the iron lung to breathe, otherwise, you know. And the young doctor said to her, how can you stand this? Every day. How can you stand it? And she said, sometimes the nurse comes in and opens the window behind me. And the breeze from the window comes in and it runs across my cheek. And she says, this experience makes it all worthwhile. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. And he would go regularly to see her. And he said, she was constantly happy. Just lovely to be around. The breeze across the cheek made it worthwhile.
I was thinking that Van Gogh was nobody to himself.
Yes. Van Gogh.
He lived only in the present.
Did he?
That's,
I don't know his story, so you have to, I just... I don't know the story, so you
no,
tell me.
Not the story.
Oh, no, all right.
What I'm aiming at is, was Mozart nobody to himself?
I don't know them, sorry. Can't tell you, sir.
Because he was, it's a friend of thought, because people who have this gift of being in something, they are doing it because they have to.
Yeah.
And they are not thinking about anything else.
No.
They are only in that, all the time in the present.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
That's one way what you're talking about.
Uh-huh. I would say, I don't know, Mr. Van Gogh and Mr. Beethoven, etc. I know, I get the idea. It would be lovely, but not possible, if you or I or anyone else could be consistently in the spirit and the activity of creativity, constantly creative and constantly absorbed in that creativity. And I quite agree with you that for some, that absorption into the creativity may be many hours every day, and extraordinarily creative and productive, and it's a delight to witness the fruits of all of that. But a human being cannot live that way all the time. There's no track record, no history of it. So there are periods of time, it may be several hours a day, of the creativity and the absorption and a joy and a satisfaction, particularly if the person's not dependent on results of what they do. But when that absorption in that creative expression stops, when one's no longer painting, no longer writing the music or whatever it is, then what? Is the wisdom there? Is,
yeah. I don't think you wasn't maybe performing it, but you're still growing there somewhere.
If it, this is in Dhamma language, it may be. If in life, though, whoever it is, I have not met anybody either in my life who is constantly absorbed in creativity and afterwards constantly, say, reflecting on it or mulling it. It's not possible. Because various other relationships and activities come into one's life, all of our lives. Various roles, various issues from the past, etc. So the creative expression is beautiful and it's lovely to witness and it's a great expression of life. But the realities of life for all of us regularly and daily put us into contact and exposure with all other kind of roles and identities. So for some, whether it's the artist or anybody, can be extraordinary creative in one area of the inner life, expressing, and unbelievably neurotic right afterwards.
It's one way to put it, but I think it's also one way to get to what you're saying.
Yeah.
You are creative, you live in the present.
Yeah, in the moment, I agree.
If you have this doubt, otherwise...
I see, yes. Yes.
It is a benefit,
I'm not done with it, but life forces us, you know, to be out of some forms of experience, and life puts us, whether we choose it or not, to be in another. And that's the challenge. Can I bring awareness and wisdom to this? Can I open up the heart to this? Can I transform this? So that we recognize and love the deep absorptions with things which are valuable. And we recognize that there are other aspects of ourselves which may require real care, real interest, real attention, real good support from others, a really good focus with ourselves to change all of that. That's why there's no one answer for anybody which will do it. If that were so, then I would say the only answer to a happy, focused, concentrated life in the here and now is to be artistic morning, noon and night. Nobody can do it.
There was Ramdas told some idea of the thing who was preaching about, he was talking in an audience about meditation.
Yes.
And this old woman was sitting in the first row with another elderly woman.
Yes.
He didn't understand, he thought maybe it's something wrong there. And after the lecture he went to her and asked, what do you know about it? So she said, I know I crochet.
Right. And some meditation. Why not? Good. Yes, anyone please. Yes.
They are situations, just a small remark, they are situations that remembering the past,
yes,
is comfort to us.
A comfort. Yes.
Losing the imagination of the past is the only thing we can do to help ourselves, for example, being in
the prison. Yes. So, I agree that, as you point out, the relationship to the past can be helpful, can provide insight, can be a resource. And, in other words, we can learn from our history, personal or collective. What would be an example in your life? Does anything come to mind for you where the relationship to the past is one of learning from the past, which is helpful? Yeah, anything that comes to mind for you.
If some people are damaged, brain damage, and
yes,
they cannot recognize the family or something.
No.
They really suffer because they
cannot. Oh, I
know. So, if I see you in the street and after a week I don't know who you are, so it's good to know the other people. I know your face.
Yes. Right. Yes. Yeah. So, the memory, our memories, you know, are very, very helpful. Our past is very helpful. I have upbringing of learning English. So, you have also put the time into learning English as well. So, that's a clear benefit. Without the past, we couldn't talk to each other this evening and listen to each other in the same language. We have the past because of our common humanity. We can talk to each other because we share what is in common, which is that we are all human. Anyway, we can talk with animals, animals can talk with us, but it's only in certain kind of ways, we might say. Relationship to the past can be that we can look at it and see what we can benefit from, and also, as I said this evening, what we may need to look at again, or may need to let go of, not just the letting go of, but in order to free us up. So, many ways of looking at the past. Question is it overshadowing something else? That's always the question. To me, it's always the question. Spiritual teachings, it's always the question. So how's the relationship, I may ask, to your past? What comes to you, I may ask? I'm asking Personally. Yes.
Not yet. Too much.
Which parts of the past would you say would be good to let go of? Which parts of the past would be good to appreciate? If you want to, you don't have to say, don't take notice just because I ask questions.
Parents' relationship.
Yes.
To be better.
Yes.
I'm not so sure. I was a little bit felt. Most I rejected a few things about you said. I didn't let go about my Jewish past.
Yes.
Sometimes I know that people feel different in this room, but when you mentioned your greatest teacher, for some people here and Jewish people,
yes,
stand on the back feet and just.
Stand on the butt.
Back. Jesus, you know, your greatest teachers.
That's the greatest. I didn't say greatest. My favorite rabbi. Yes.
You stand
back. What happened? Eh? You stand on guard. That's why I say it. I could have said something and quoted somebody else or something. I come to Israel often enough. The rabbi from Nazareth gets mentioned more often here than anywhere else in the world by me. It's intentional. I want to do it.
Why do you want to be Jewish?
Eh? He's Jewish. That's a good answer. Because sometimes there's a little, for some people, doesn't matter one way or the other, but I know sometimes in the very orthodox Jewish world his name was not allowed to be mentioned. He was called the hanged one, and the word Jesus was not allowed to be mentioned in some home.
Yeshua is too much.
So these things, and similarly with the afternoon meeting that we had, the Dharma teacher. Dharma teachers, part of our role and responsibility is to touch places, which of course touch the heart, which invite questioning, but Dharma teaching is also to see if there's holding. And that would come in, say, reactivity, defensiveness, resentment. And just, and part of the function is to...
I think it's enforcing what you're doing, because...
There is.
I think that you're saying, I'm the only one here who's going to talk about history. I'm going to refer to the Holocaust and some assume it into the Second World War and interpret Jewish English-German relations and subsume Jewish relations to Germany in that.
Sorry, a little bit fast for me.
Both in relation now to the Second World War and in relation to Jesus, I feel that you're saying, well, you know, you're using history, but if I'm to relate to that history, it'll be to constructing an over rigid identity. I mean, I'm learning from you about the cloud that's passing.
Yes.
But it's just that you do keep provoking me because you're using history,
and I
read history differently from you.
All right.
And I want to read history as likely as you do, but I may not say the same things about it, and I'm interested in the force of your examples. And you're drawing examples from history.
Yeah.
So if you're drawing examples, I mean, and you're the teacher, and in a way you're using the examples to say things, and what you're saying, at the end of the day, I probably agree, I tend to agree with you, because the common ground is more important than the difference.
Yeah.
But you're also using examples from history, in the crudest bottom line, in error. That's how I feel about it, and it hurts me. And I think, well, if you can talk about history, why can't I?
Yes, right. You're welcome. It's a free and open forum in this case. For those who weren't here, in the afternoon meeting, as you point out, use example from history. And I said that after the terrible events of what I said was 20 million died, somebody else I think said 70 million died. 60 million was it, the figure? Yeah, had died during the Second World War. That in Europe, with all that took place, and the historical example that I gave was an attempt for different communities, in this case I refer to French and German, English and German, to start talking together. To twin the towns together. Plymouth, where you were brought up, was twinned with another town. Totnes, where I live, was twinned with a town, etc. And to start people to start talking and meeting together. And I think that those kind of gestures by men and women are very beautiful. And I want, again, to use history to inspire us. I want to use history to encourage us, to help feel and sense our love and connection with each other, no matter how bad the past was. And I think we'd all agree that it couldn't get much badder, shall we say, than what took place in the Second World War. So I wanted to inspire, not to be used for conflict. That was the intention.
There is some conflict with me because the words I use about that moment in history...
Yes. Oh, I see.
And I'm sorry, the totalitarian in me is saying until you say something that I can recognise so that we have a shared past, I've got conflict with you that is still unresolved.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Because I think that when England and Germany I want to use history in a life affirming, that perhaps something isn't true if it isn't life affirming. I mean, that's what I'm playing with.
Yeah.
And maybe the truth is life-affirming, even, and I know that you're not someone who won't look at difficult things.
No.
And I think that can I say any more, is it already irrelevant? Because I'm still waiting to say to you what I think about history. And in its crudest form, I think, first of all, although, in 1942, the Council of Christians and Jews was formed by Jews and Christians who saw that there were going to be problems between Jews and Christians because of the responsibility of Christian teachings for what was happening to the Jews.
I see.
So that was before your peacemaking example of England twinning towns with Germany.
Yeah, I see. Mm-hmm.
And I am riding on the back of peacemaking between England and Germany that hasn't been done specifically by Jews, and it's a beautiful thing in my life that I can enjoy Wim Wenders films and have German friends and stuff.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
So I do ride on the back of those.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I also see that Germany and England could neither. I believe that neither of them cared about the plight of the Jews. So it's easy for them to twin towns in 1945. They just had a war.
I see.
Meanwhile, the Jews of Europe were being wiped out. They weren't twinning towns so soon.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Good. Thank you. Yes, anyone, please.
Do you think there is something useful in teaching or learning history? Or shall this profession be
I'm a very small student of history, and I find in different places, countries, continents that I go to, that regular reading does help to inform me a great deal. And as we know, in this particular region of the world, the dirty fingerprints of the English, French and Turks all over the area in this long and painful history. And I think sometimes the historical perspective genuinely can be helpful. I think it is important to look at ways and means that meaningful change has taken place. It's important to see what has affected and who has affected change. What are the strategies? And so for some of us, they're sources of inspiration. Nelson Mandela, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, etc. There are voices around and traditions around and spiritual and religious traditions around. If we didn't have access to the history, if we didn't have access to the texts, etc., we couldn't use them as a really great resource for insight and understanding in the present. I can't see the point of, like at school, just learning history for history's sake. But if in some way or other it informs me in a healthy and an inspiration and insightful way today, helps me to understand today better, it's a wonderful and precious resource. And once again, coming to attitude, once again coming to intention. Yeah, but for its own sake, not my cup of tea. Yes, please. Yes.
Can I say something to Mark?
Yeah, do. Yeah. It's a very open forum. I'm more than happy to stand back.
I'm not sure I allow myself to say that my whole family was murdered in the Holocaust, so I don't speak about it, or not a Catholic teacher, English teacher, to speak about it. And I know the pain of that very person, not from historical books. And yet, I just wonder, I do think about it and wonder why it happened to the Jewish people and to my family. And I try not to look at it always from a victim point of view. And I think about the Palestinians too, like Christopher said today, but which I thought was extraordinary that they sit there and practice patience under unbelievable circumstances, which I doubt that I would, in their place, I would have that patience. I would go out to the streets and throw stones and bottles and everything, and like I'm sure most of us do too. And yet there's, in extreme circumstances, there is extreme opportunity. I mean, I don't like the word opportunity, but I can't think of something better.
Why?
It sounds, I don't know, new age. But there's, but in the extremes, there is a, sometimes there is like a diamond there, which needs to be found.
I think like that my difficulty in hearing what Christopher was saying arose in the context of other histories. Jewish Israeli history and Palestinian history was all part of that session.
I said that in this context.
And I know what's difficult for me is knowing that I can't control other people's representations of history. I can't wait for everyone to tell the story the way I want to, or even be sure that the way I want it to be told is the right one. But I know that common ground is important, because I'm beginning to think that some shared idea of what's true in the past can be useful. And the woman who was sitting over there was talking about Palestinian friends, close friends it seems, who couldn't hear about her feelings that were in some way connected with identity. But I agreed with her. She was saying she had to be able to be herself, bring herself to her friends, otherwise what's a friend? And that's, I mean, I'm pushing it for the family, I'm sorry.
Mark had referred to earlier, we touched a little bit on lunchtime, I had an invitation of a New York and London publisher after September 11th, wrote a book called Transforming Our Terror. And on the day of September the 11th, I was in an airplane over American airspace, and the pilot said to us on plane that it was not permitted for any planes in the air. I think it was 3,000 or 4,000, a huge number of planes over American airspace. No planes were permitted to land and had to return back to the place of departure. So we had to fly back to London there. And 58 planes leave every day from London Heathrow Airport alone for the United States, so you can imagine the chaos and confusion. I was reading a book of the diaries of Etty Hillesum, who was in Amsterdam and then sent to Westerbork and to the concentration camp. And she is a very important person in my life. I have read her writings many, many times, read her diaries, read her letters, and on that flight I was sitting there reading the book again, which I've read many, many times there, and I've quoted from her many times. I've given talks in Jerusalem with regard to Etty Hillesum. And a mutual friend of Stephen and I in Kiel, Erica Kohler, knew Etty, and I felt it was a tremendous privilege to actually meet somebody who actually knew her and helped to make me feel closer. And she is another extraordinary example of the power of the human spirit to live a free and extraordinarily independent life in the midst of the most obscene terror imaginable. And I say again that I do feel with history and with the past, there can be, I think for us as human beings on the earth, extraordinary and wonderful resources for us to encourage us, to nourish us, to give us support in the face of difficulty. I had a meeting with Aung San Suu Kyi. She was the elected democratic leader of Burma, now called Myanmar, and one of the most brutal military regimes which uses Buddhism to support itself, and uses the name Buddhism, refuse to accept the overwhelming support for Aung San Suu Kyi. They imprisoned her in her house. They cut off all access. They arrested, tortured and executed many of her close friends in the NDP, National Democratic Party of Burma. I went to meet with her, and through various friends, etc., etc., was able to meet with her through my Buddhist role, blah, blah. And she said to me, I said to her, what's it like? You'd been at that time 7 or 8 years in this house. It was bugged. To have any conversation, private conversation, one had to go out in the garden, because you couldn't say anything in the house without it being recorded and listened to. When one got to the gate of our house, there were soldiers there. The government wouldn't let soldiers be in control of the front of the house in case they came to like her. So they can only be on guard duty for 1 week at a time, in case they became friends with her. So that paranoid about Aung San Suu Kyi. I said, how do you stick with it? Her husband and her two sons were in Oxford. He's a Tibetan, he was dead now, he's a Tibetologist, teaching Tibetan, history Tibetan, culture Tibetan Buddhism.